Hi, welcome to Money Matters TV. I'm your host, Patty Tuadros, and today I am joined by Paul Mitchell.
Hi, Patty. Good to see you.
Paul, always fun to chat with you.
Yes.
So now we see the president settling in and the economy's doing well so far.
Well, certainly the stock market's doing very, very well.
It's exciting, isn't it?
It's been a long run and that type of thing, to the extent that people are starting to say, well, you know, maybe it's time for a correction if it keeps going one direction too long.
Yeah, that is scary, but it is nice to see my retirement account actually increasing for a change. It was just dabbling a little bit up and down, and now it's...
Congratulations.
Yeah.
Maybe it's time to reallocate your investment strategy or something like that.
Yeah, you know, I went with one of those funds that you put in your retirement year and then it keeps changing for you. Mm-hmm. Because I know that if it was up to me to manage it, I would remember the year before I retired that I had all stocks and no bonds and a very bad portfolio. How about you?
Well, I don't have that much of a portfolio left.
Yeah.
So I'm still working.
Yeah.
Or looking and that type of thing, you know, staying in banking and trying to make a living that way and all.
How are banks reacting to what's going on? As far as I know, you're a commercial lender.
Yes. Well, overall, one of the primary things is regulation. The banks were, you know, hammered specifically after the big recession 8-9 years ago, and the Dodd-Frank Act was passed, and that was specifically aimed at banks and to regulate them more, et cetera, et cetera. And indeed, there were certain banks, a bunch of them, that were largely responsible for much of the crash that occurred.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have several thousand banks around the country, clearly, not a majority, not even 10%, I would say, were doing bad things which would cause problems in the economy. But with the way the government works, they pass regulations to fix a few bad problems.
And now they roll them back?
And everybody suffers.
And what are these repeals mean, that or the executive orders that Trump is signing?
Well, they're talking about rolling back some of the regulations, exactly.
So he signed it, is it done, or it has to now go through Congress?
It'd have to go through Congress.
So I can't imagine that's really going to pass, that they're going to throw out regulations.
Well, one of his things he has said, I think, with the executive order, is that for every new regulation that is that comes into being, you've got to eliminate one or two.
Well, that makes sense. It seems like there's a lot of excessive regulations, just questionable, the things that they're potentially rolling back.
Well, if it impacts the freedom to do business, efficiently, that can be a problem, and that's where it's come to, where small banks have the burden of almost the same levels of compliance as large banks, and they're ill prepared to be able to pay for that. They're paying, maybe 2, 3, 4, half a dozen people just to deal with compliance issues, as opposed to running the bank, meeting customers, making loans, getting deposits, going out in the community and whatever. They're in the office dealing with government regulations, which contribute nothing to the bottom line. Just the opposite. It hits the bottom line terribly, because if a person is making $50,000 or $60,000 a year, fully loaded with benefits, et cetera, it could be $300,000, it could be $1 million a year just for regulation compliance.
So now with the some of these regulations rolling back, it might roll down to these smaller banks in a good way.
It could. It should.
Yeah.
It should.
That's good. A few weeks ago, there was a guest on here that I chatted with who's an accountant, and he said that some of the things, the tax breaks that could be coming for small business would be really good. Have you heard anything about that?
Not that much. I think the main problems that small businesses have are more related to regulation and things that make it hard to do business, to open a business, to expand a business, than paying taxes per se. I mean, it depends what you mean by a small business. If you're talking about a company with $500,000 or $3 million of revenues or something like that, my definition of a small business, I don't think that the tax laws are going to have that much of an impact on how they do business.
You know, the thing that I do think impacts all businesses is healthcare.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
I think it's completely unaffordable, not an affordable CARE Act. And I know that all the regulations for businesses to carry or offer insurance to their employees is really, it's great that they have to do it. And at the same time, it's really impacted business because it's so expensive.
Absolutely.
I have clients that said they went out and they just gave their employees money to go on the open market and pay the penalties.
Yeah,
so hopefully whatever's coming next will be better for everybody.
Sure. Have you ever taken a look at if you were sick or bought pills recently or whatever, use your health insurance at all in the last few years, you get this mailing. And one of the first things, you open this thing, it has several pages in it. You open it up, and the first thing it says, this is not a bill. And I go, well, why does it look like a bill then? And it goes on for three or four pages about, you know, about privacy, you know, these breakdown of the thing, of charges and this and that and whatever. It's so complicated. It's like, how can a person understand this? It's like an insurance policy. Well, that's regulations. Why can't they just say it a simplified thing, half a page, if you want more information, you know, we'll send you more. But it's just, it's an awful lot to deal with. And they have to comply. If they screw up, they miss something, they're gonna get in trouble, pay a big fine.
So they're paying someone to come up with the structure.
Absolutely.
They're paying somebody to mail it. And then you get it, you throw it away because it doesn't make any sense.
I financed a company in this area about 3 or 4 years ago. They're still in business and doing fine. There were several people that worked at large health insurance companies. And they left and started their own company specifically aimed at helping large insurance companies deal with all these new regulations, for example, recoding every procedure, every pill, everything. I said, how can that be a big deal? Well, they were getting retained by, you know, insurance companies for $500,000 a year to do all this stuff. Mm-hmm. Big business.
Right.
What sense does that make?
It's crazy.
These guys are making, you know, a living out of it, a good living out of it. And it's probably going to continue because it's one thing after another. Just in the software business, you have these big events that give you a lot of business. Whether it's, you know, Y2K, that big crisis. Remember that? Never was a problem. But talking about people that got into the business, wow.
Oh, my mom stockpiled canned goods, water.
Sure, it's going to be a disaster.
She got cash out, yeah.
Well, then when Y2K, when the year 2000 came and went, all those people that are making a living out of it, advising people, well, they had to go do something else.
Can you imagine? You want a refund for that when it came and passed with nothing.
Exactly.
So let's talk more about commercial lending. When you
sure.
think about all this new construction in Philadelphia,
yes.
every time you turn around, there's another high-rise going up.
Very good point. Right. To the extent that suburban banks are now buying banks in Philadelphia or moving offices into Philadelphia to try to participate in this boom, I'll say. So I looked at it and said, well, Philadelphia is booming. I mean, Philadelphia, generally speaking, is not booming. But this construction activity relative to in the suburbs are doing fine, but there's more activity in Philadelphia, kind of a renaissance. Well, now banks are even talking about maybe there's too much.
Too much construction?
Too much new availability of housing, new housing.
Oh, right. Well, there's going to be a cap. There's only so many people to live here, right?
Well, there's no cap on how many apartments and condos they can build.
Right, but eventually no one's going to buy them.
That's what the banks are starting to say. So they're saying that we have to be more cautious.
Wow.
And part of it is just tracking what's going on. I mean, if you finance somebody that is good at building apartments, has been around for 20 years, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that's terrific. And you're going to build a facility with 100 apartments. That's great. Sounds quite reasonable, et cetera, et cetera. Well, do you know how many other good builders or lousy builders, okay, are out there also building 100 apartment places? So then the new availability of housing is going to be maybe for 3,000 apartments. Well, what's the absorption rate based upon people moving into Philadelphia and making homes in Philadelphia? Is it 3,000? 3,200? 1,500? There's your problem.
Maybe, you know, well, we're a sanctuary city, so maybe it's a... They need housing for all the people that are hiding here.
Well, most of the new construction is not aimed at...
No, I'm just kidding.
That type of housing.
Yeah.
Income.
So and we have a really interesting guest. So I have a question for you before we
sure.
move on. So there's a gentleman named Roger Timmons here in Philadelphia, and he asks, is a construction loan better with a bank than a regular loan with a bank?
Okay. I think the emphasis is on, is it a construction loan versus a regular loan? Well, the key thing is that, are you doing construction? And I'll just use a generic example. Let's say somebody wants to build a house to live in. It's going to cost, the house is going to be worth $300,000. Okay, so right now there's a piece of ground. Okay, well, the way a construction loan typically works is that the ground And the ground value represents the equity into the project. Just like buying a house, you got to put down 10, 15, 20, 25% typically in order to qualify for a mortgage. Just like any loan, a bank doesn't want to, needs collateral that has a cushion to it, not it's going to lend the last dollar based upon the value of the collateral. So it's going to cost $200,000 now to roughly to build the house. All right. Well, if you just go out and get a loan for $200,000, well, how are you going to repay it?
Like a mortgage.
But you don't have the collateral there yet. The house isn't there yet, right?
Right.
You got to put, you know, concrete in the ground, a foundation. You got to put up, you know, a 2x4s for framing, a roof.
Yeah, so what would they give you this loan for? You would just take a, yeah.
Well, a construction loan is a specific type of loan, very specialized. Not every bank does them. Most banks, you'll find a bank in most areas. And it's going to be geared to the size of the bank. That is, a $200,000 loan is generally not going to be made by a Wells Fargo bank to build your $200,000, $300,000 house.
That's too small?
It's too small.
Okay.
But a local bank, they do bigger deals. But a local bank could be very interested. But it's specialized. Again, not everybody does it because you have to have a specialized people that handle that kind of loan in the bank. And also, you have to rely upon other outside experts. What kind of outside experts? Well, okay, here's the way a construction loan is going to work. You've got your ground worth $100,000. You need $200,000 to finish the house. Okay, the collateral value right now is $100,000. So I might lend you $75,000 on that. Okay, what are you going to do with the $75,000? Well, you can get the project going. You can pay a builder to put in the foundation, put in the first 2x4s. There's $75,000 that's been spent. Okay.
It goes in phases.
Bingo.
That's kind of horrifying. What if you don't get a, that's just how you have these half-constructed homes?
But it protects the borrower and it protects the bank. It goes in phases. So an inspector then, hired by the bank, goes out and takes a look at what's been done for $75,000. Did it meet the plan that had been presented before? Yes, looks like a good job. There's now another $70,000 of collateral value sort of there. We can advance some more for the next phase. The next phase might be, you know, finishing off in the inside, or it might be the roof, or it might be you know, putting all the appliances in, that type of thing. It might be, you know, landscaping. Typically, I'd say 4 to 5 to 6 phases. The bank will make an advance, see the work's been done. It gets certified by an outside appraiser. Bank goes to the next level.
So two questions.
The final thing is that, okay, so now we've advanced to $200,000. There's a $300,000 project, the land for $100,000, $200,000 for the project. Now, and usually the bank wants to see this ahead of time, it's going to convert, that $300,000 is going to convert to a mortgage, a long-term mortgage of some kind.
Now what if I'm a builder and I want to sell it to somebody?
Well,
would a builder take a construction loan, or is the
Absolutely. It's harder for builders to do that these days because the bank wants to see that there's a buyer for the house. If there's not, it's called a spec construction loan. Mm-hmm. A spec house, a sample house. Speculative.
Right.
They're going to build it, hoping somebody's going to buy it. And if somebody doesn't buy it, it's a disaster.
Serious.
With the Great Recession, an awful lot of that happened.
Right.
An awful lot of that happened. So, the kind of loan should match the purpose that the loan is for. Now, if you don't get a construction loan and you want to do construction on your own, you can do that. But what kind of collateral are you going to offer the bank? It's going to be maybe a first or second mortgage on your existing home, okay? And you get your $200,000 and you go out and do it on your own. And hopefully you do it in phases and know what you're doing, you don't make a mistake. You could use cash collateral, CDs, savings accounts, stocks and bonds, good collateral. So if it doesn't work out, the bank's not looking at this project that has no idea what's going on. It's looking at other collateral.
I just have one follow-up question before we move on. Does the bank give you a schedule ahead of time that says when you hit this milestone, we'll release more money?
It's all agreed upon, yes.
Yeah.
You were asked, the bank has forms and presented to you and the builder, of course, and the plan is put into place. Okay, at this level, this is what's going to happen.
Okay.
This is what's going to happen. This is what's going to happen. And there's got to be some leeway, too. You know, it rains a lot, you know, the builder, you know, doesn't do it on time, things like that.
Right.
So people have to know, you know, everything that's going on. And that's why really the bank is there to, I'll say, to protect you.
Okay.
They're not going to get involved in a construction loan with maybe the builder's doing it for the first time. Maybe your brother-in-law, you may think that's a good deal. He doesn't have experience. Banks probably won't do it.
Right. Well, that was a really thought-out answer. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I know that Roger Timmons will appreciate that.
Well, having been a banker for a long time, I've seen the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you. And if you have questions, here to how to send them in.
You can have your questions answered on Money Matters. Please go to our website, money-matterstv.com. On our homepage, click on the banner on the right that says, Send Us Your Questions. While you're on our website, you can find information about our host and guests, as well as show notes and links about this show and past shows. Money Matters is also available as a podcast on iTunes and Stitcher, so you can listen to Money Matters while you're on the go. That website address, again, is money, M-O-N-E-Y, dash matters, M-A-T-T-E-R-S, TV.com.
Welcome back. I'm excited to meet and talk with our guest, Jim DiLorenzo. It's nice to meet you. You have your own firm, Jim DiLorenzo PR. Right?
Yes, thank you. Thank you for asking me here. And yes, I have my own business, Jim DiLorenzo Public Relations. I've been in the public relations field for all of my adult life, dating back to my high school years.
Yeah. Well, what did you do when you were in high school in PR?
I actually started writing small stories for the newspapers in my hometown about our sports teams in my high school, and driving them over to the two papers in my hometown in Trenton, New Jersey. And the two papers at the time were located directly across the street from each other, so I would run one copy of the story into the one newspaper and go across the street with another copy. And eventually people began to say, you have some talent here, we're really appreciative of this, maybe you want to consider this a career. And when I got to college at Villanova University, I started doing that as a volunteer in their sports information office, and eventually I became a full-time employee there. And it was all kind of a blessing, if you will, a happenstance, that I got interested in this area and I showed a talent for it, and I had mentors that encouraged me all along the way.
I just want to diverge a little bit for half a second.
Absolutely.
Villanova, March Madness is going to start. Are
yes.
you excited?
I'm always Especially excited.
Especially being been in the sports office.
Yes, I'm always excited by March and the NCAA tournament and the Big East tournament. Having been the public relations executive in charge of men's basketball in the mid-90s, and having been associated with the team from 1980 to 1995, I have a lot of enthusiasm and a lot of experiences, and every year there's a new excitement. And this year, with Villanova being the defending national champion and having already had a wonderful season to this point, and the Big East tournament coming up very soon, and the NCAA tournament coming up very soon, it's an exciting time to be a college basketball fan and to be a Villanova fan and alumnus.
That's great PR.
Yeah, right? That's a free plug for Villanova.
They don't need my help right now.
No, they don't. So how does PR and social media combine together for something like that, if we use that as a model?
Certainly. Well, that, again, the whole area of social media is something that has taken off in the last 10 years, especially, last 8 years, in fact, since Twitter came about. But from a public relations standpoint, it's a real great way to get your message out. If you have a particular story angle, or if you have a particular message that you're trying to promote in the public arena, social media and public relations are very well tied together. So the NCAA tournament, you will see a lot of messages going out from sponsors. You'll see a lot of messages coming out from other companies trying to piggyback, if you will, on March Madness. Even though the NCAA has a trademark on March Madness, people still try to find ways to work around it and say, you know, March frenzy or March excitement. But the whole idea of the month of March being a very exciting time for college basketball fans and for businesses and people and properties that are like to ride the coattails of the NCAA tournament, it's a great opportunity for people to get their stories out there, because people are following March Madness. People are following college basketball. They have a tremendous outpouring of support for Villanova in particular in this area, but for all the teams and all the people who are alumni, people who are fans. You have a massive network to tap into that are following those stories. And if you can come up with an idea that kind of generates some excitement that is at the same time based on that. A lot of people do fundraising for nonprofits and for charities during March that are tied into the NCAA tournament, and that's a great opportunity for people to get their stories out there.
Nice. Jim, how has public relations changed in recent years?
Well, again, social media is a big change in the way public relations professionals approach their customers and approach their audiences. Another big factor that has changed has been the transition from the daily newspaper, the print edition, a weekly magazine or a monthly magazine, to the online space, the online publication. The 24/7 nature of the news media and the media in general has completely overwhelmed some people in this day and age. When I go out and I talk to clients or potential clients, there's still a reluctance to, okay, we're not going after this newspaper, or we're not going after this publication, we're not going after this TV show. Yes, you are, but you're going after them in a different way. You want to reach their audience online, you want to reach their audience that's going to their website or going to reading their blogs or reading their content. So there's a whole level of changes as far as where the audience is. There's a definite fragmentation of the audience, but there's also a lot of new ways to reach an audience. So public relations has had to adapt to the changes in the way the public relates to your story or to your message.
Do you see segmentation by age on different platforms?
Yes, there is a segmentation by the demographics, the age, the interests, the locations, but the online platforms that you can use, whether it be Facebook, whether it be Twitter, whether it be your own website or a blog, there are different ways to target those demographics, to target those ages, those demographic groups, location, and it's a lot easier to target a specific demographic through the internet and through online channels than it ever was before. We would, in the old days, when I first started out in this business, if you will, we would measure column inches in a newspaper. We would cut out the actual newspaper article, we would measure how many inches it was, we would find out what their circulation was for each issue, and then we would calculate how many people saw it. Well, now, through the magic of the internet and social media and other channels, we can actually find out who read the story, where were they located, where did they find it, did they stick with it for more than 5 seconds, did they read the whole thing, did they send it on to somebody else, did they share it?
Can you find out how old they are?
You can find out how old they are.
Whoa.
And you can even target Facebook or LinkedIn or other advertising venues, Google AdWords. You can target a specific age group, you can target a specific region, you can target a specific neighborhood even. It's gotten that granular.
Jim, I deal primarily with small and medium-sized businesses, and I think Patty's kind of in that area too. I mean, I generally don't think of them using public relations as a tool. It sounds like another expensive thing for larger companies that people really care about or something.
Or restaurants, right?
Yes.
I get it.
There's a lot of different ways, and again, small businesses are one of the areas that I work closely with, and one of the things that I try to put in people's minds is you're paying for a lawyer, you're paying for an accountant. Look at a public relations professional as a professional service that you're using to help build
your
business.
You're paying for XRSL.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You're paying for for your development, you're paying for your website, you're paying for other materials, your marketing materials. So public relations, if you look at it in that regard, yes, it's another expense, but also for a small business owner or entrepreneur, what is that person comfortable doing? Well, they've built a business or they've built a company that's based on their particular interest or skill set, and they focus very clearly on that particular skill set. Mm-hmm. when it comes time to getting that story told in the marketplace of ideas, you want somebody that can dedicate themselves full-time to telling your story. Mm-hmm. So, sometimes it's not beneficial for a business owner or an executive to be the one telling that story because they have so many other things to concentrate mm-hmm. on to yeah. build their business. So you want to engage just as you would an attorney, just as you would an accountant, just as mm-hmm. you would engage a marketer. You want to engage a public relations professional yeah. to help you tell that story.
How do you separate yourself from someone who's just a marketing specialist?
Well, I think marketing specialists are very important, and I like to work hand in glove with them, because I think a marketing executive, a marketing consultant, has a very specific skill set, just like a business owner has a very specific mm-hmm. skill set. And my particular skill set is selling a story in the marketplace.
To the media,
to an audience, whether it be a
story, it's not a product or a service.
Exactly.
A story, so I'm selling about the story. Your business. Right.
And that's my expertise. I love to write. I love to find new stories. I love to find new audiences for the story. I actively network with people every day. And just as someone like you would network with people to help build your business and to work with your clients on the marketing side of things, mm-hmm. I do the same thing so that I'm meeting reporters, I'm meeting producers, I'm meeting bloggers, I'm meeting people who can tell your story, and I'm selling your story to that audience.
I had talked to a PR person three years ago when I thought, I want my company Zercel. When someone thinks I need to do my website, Zercel's who you call. And I went and met with this firm and I talked to them about it, and I just didn't feel like they could guarantee me any sort of return. Can you, and we only have a couple minutes left.
Sure.
Tell me about that.
It's very hard to guarantee placement, and I like to talk about earned media coverage. In other words, your story is earning the attention of the media. How do we get that out there? And then we leverage that. Mm-hmm. So I like to try to take the approach, and this again comes from my sports background, winning in your own backyard. So if you can win a game, say when I was at Villanova, we had a great track and field coach by the name of Marty Stern. And Marty Stern preached the philosophy, let's win in our own backyard, then we can win. Like if we can beat Cabrini and we can beat Bryn Mawr and we can beat Haverford, then we can beat Temple, we can beat Penn, we can beat LaSalle, and then we can beat Penn State, then we can beat North Carolina, then we
right.
can beat. So you keep growing outward. So get the low-hanging fruit, get the audience in your immediate backyard that you can sell your story to. Leverage that to get other media coverage, whether it be the Philadelphia Business Journal resulting mm-hmm. in the Wall Street Journal, or whether it be Channel 10 News resulting in NBC News nationally. You try to leverage okay. each opportunity. So you start small and you grow outwards and you continue the process.
So Jim, if somebody wants to get some good PR advice from a real pro, how would they contact you?
Well, I'm all over the internet, fortunately or unfortunately. So my email address is out there. Jim@jhdenterprises.com, and I'm at Twitter at jhd16, and my website is jhdenterprises.com.
Very good.
Great.
Sounds like you're promoting yourself pretty good. Good. You got some good PR going for you.
Well, I try, and I have a lot of people that I work with. I tend to stay behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. This is the first time in a long time I've been in front of the camera instead of behind the camera.
Well, we enjoyed having you. And
absolutely.
It was great chatting. We really appreciate you guys joining us today for the show. We hope you'll join us again soon. Our next guest is Albert Dandridge, Esquire, from Schneider, Harrison, Siegel & Lewis. We look forward to seeing you again soon. Thanks.